We are going to be looking at Genesis 14 this morning. Genesis 14. Before we do that, however, I want to go back to Genesis 12 and 13 just a little bit. I don't like to do this. I like to start with brand new material. But we didn't quite finish, and it's important, and I believe it'll also help us in our study of Genesis 14. I also feel bad making y'all be quiet so we can start class. But we're very glad that everyone enjoys each other, love to be together, and we'll have time enough for that. Good morning. Good to see you today. Like I said, we're going to go back just a little bit. I want to remind you that we see some interesting events in the life of Abraham, and I want to show you how they eventually find their way in the book of Exodus. So here you have a famine that causes Abram, he's still called Abram, to flee from the land of Canaan and go to, where does he go? Goes to Egypt. So he flees to Egypt. While they're in Egypt, he runs into the king, and that of course is Pharaoh. And Pharaoh takes Sarai, Abram's wife, into his harem. She is not violated at all. That's very important for the Abrahamic promise, because it's through Abraham and Sarah they're going to have a child. What does God cause to happen to Pharaoh and his household because he has Sarai? Well, the plagues is, and that's the same word that is going to be used throughout Exodus. And then he sends them away. There in verse number 20, sends Abram and his family away. Get away from me. That's exactly right. He doesn't plunder him, but he takes a lot of livestock and that's there in verse 16. Sheep, oxen, male donkeys, male servants. So he leaves much richer than he had been. Those find parallels with the Exodus. They go to Egypt. Why? Because of a famine. And they interact with the Pharaoh. And so as you go into Exodus, you see the Israelites enslaved. And God delivers them with plagues. They finally leave because Pharaoh gives in after the 10th plague. And as Gus just indicated, they left richer than when they had gotten there. At least during the period of slavery. So, how many of you like the Lord of the Rings? You've got the Lord of the Rings, the Two Towers, the Return of the King. How does The Hobbit, the novel The Hobbit, fit into all that?
Sets it in motion.
Do what?
It starts the story.
It starts the story. So, a lot of times today they'll have episodes 1, 2, and 3, and then they say, okay, that's been successful, let's go to the backstory. And they call it a prequel. Not a sequel, but a prequel. It's hard to imagine this, at least it is for me, but Genesis is very much like a prequel. We love the stories of Abraham and Joseph. We relish in those stories. But Genesis serves as a backdrop for the monumental event in Israelite history, and that is the Exodus. This is but one example of parallels, foreshadowing of the events that are unfolded in Exodus. Just wanted to mention that to you because I find that very, very fascinating. We also did not finish chapter 13. I'll remind you that Abram messed up in Exodus in Egypt, and it seems that he needs to reaffirm his faith. He's very rich. Verse 2 of Genesis 13 tells us, and it says that in verse 4, he made an altar, and there Abram called upon the name of the Lord. That's very important. He called upon the name of the Lord. There's a conflict between Abram and Lot in verses 5 through 13. You remember how God had said, Abram, as you're leaving Ur and Haran now, you need to leave your family behind and just go. Let's go, and I'll show you, I'll lead you to the land that I will show you. Who does he take with him, though? He does take some family. His nephew Lot. We are never told this, but I wonder if Abram, 75 years old, his wife 65 years old, I wonder if he's thinking to himself, I need an heir, because obviously I can't have any kids. And maybe he thought of Lot as his heir apparent. Well, he and Lot have a conflict, and they end up separating. I wonder how that affected Abram, because they're not going to ever get back together. But Abram does say, look, we need to resolve this. We are brothers. We can't be arguing like this. And what does Lot do? He is given the opportunity to pick wherever he wants to live. And what does it say? It's he lifted up his eyes, verse 10 of Genesis 13, and he saw the Jordan Valley, that it was well watered everywhere, like the garden of the Lord. What is that referring to?
Eden.
Isn't that interesting? Nestled right there. Like the land of Egypt in the direction of Zoar. This was before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. We'll get to the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 18. But in Genesis 14, we're going to find Lot living in Sodom and Gomorrah. Was this a good move for Lot? No. He ends up losing all of his livestock in the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, most of his family, except two of his daughters. And that's a sordid story that we will get to. I want to remind you, though, that what Abram does is kind and generous. And he lets Lot pick. And we said, no, Lot didn't pick the right place. He was looking more at the physical. Sometimes people decide to move somewhere. They're really thinking about it, a job promotion or whatever. They have to be transferred. Do we think about, well, is this a good place to raise my family? Is there a good church where we're moving to? And I would hope people moving to Corpus would say, yes, there is. There's the Parkway Church. Well, there are people who may move somewhere, and it's really not going to be helpful for their family. We are people who walk by faith, not by sight. Lot walked by sight. He saw how great it was going to be and ignored the sinful people in Sodom. Be that as it may, God tells Abram, I'm going to take care of you. He repeats these promises. Maybe Lot is thinking, or Abram is thinking, I just let Lot leave me. He was supposed to be my heir. I don't know. I have no idea for that, about that for sure. But God affirms his covenant with Abram. So look at verse number 14. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated from him, this is what God says to Abram, lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. For all the land that you see, I will give to you and to your offspring forever. You look at those two verses and compare them with verse 10. You've got a lot of the same language. Abram was told to lift up his eyes. Verse 10, Lot lifted up his eyes. Abram was told to look. Lot saw the Jordan Valley. And that's what he chose. Well, God says, I'm going to give this land to you. Isn't that interesting? Just a few verses separating these verses that have the same kind of language. Who's walking by faith here? Abraham. He's listening to God. Did he listen to God when he went to Egypt? There was the famine. It hit. Does the text ever tell us that God told Abram, go to Egypt during the time of famine? Doesn't. And we contrast that with Isaac, who was told specifically by God, don't go to Egypt, when he also was in Canaan and a famine arose. We'll get to that when we get to Genesis chapter 26. There are a lot of parallels, quite frankly, between Abraham and Isaac, and we'll be getting to that in just a couple of weeks. So I wanted to point out some of these connections that I find very, very fascinating. Abram had, I think, messed up when he went to Egypt, but he certainly makes up for it by reaffirming his commitment, building an altar to the Lord. He built an altar in verse 4 of Genesis 13, he builds an altar in verse 18. The closing verse there. All right, that brings us now to Genesis chapter 14, which is the focus of what we'll be studying today. And a very famous character in this story. We don't talk about him a whole lot. Melchizedek. We will be looking at that when we get down to verse number 17. Right now, we got to get through a war. Verses 1 through 16. I know you can't see this map as well as I would like for you to, but this is a hand-drawn map, came out in the 80s, and I've just always enjoyed it because it breaks what we're reading down very, very carefully. So we've got where Abraham was in verse 18 at Hebron, Genesis 13, verse 18. It does seem that he moves to the south of the Dead Sea. So you see the Dead Sea up here. And so there's the Dead Sea. It's possible that maybe Abram lives down here. This is where Lot lives, in this area right here, at the southwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. There are five kings dwelling in this area. The king of Sodom, for example. And they are vassal kings. They have been defeated by a different group of kings. And they rebelled. And there's about a period of a year that they have freedom. 12 years they had served. Verse 4. Chedorlaomer. That name just sounds evil, doesn't it? Chedorlaomer. I like saying that name. But in the 13th year they rebelled. And the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim at Asheroth Karnaim, and Zuzim and Ham, and Emim and Shavah Kiriathaim, and the Horites in their hill country at Seir as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. They are a fighting machine here, and they are coming to defeat these rebellious kings around Sodom. Verse 8, the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboiim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out and they joined battle in the valley of Siddim, or Siddim, we might say, with these four kings, Chedorlaomer, Tidal, Amraphel, Shinar, and Arioch. Four kings against five. Well, you would think four against five, the four are going to lose. But they are much stronger than these five. They defeat these kings in the valley of Siddim, and they took all their possessions. Verse 11. They took so the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah, and their provisions, and went away. And so that's nice. That's a great little story. Wait a minute. How does it relate to Abraham? Who lives in Sodom? Lot. And so we see in verse 12, they also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. And Abram says, that's too bad. I really hate that happened. Because it's four strong, powerful armies who have swooped in, taken Lot, and headed back north. There's a trail. It's called the King's Highway. And it still exists today. It's a well-paved, well-traveled road there and throughout the history of the Israelite nation and to the north. They're heading back home. What does Abram decide to do, though? He pursues them. So let's walk through this. So I've got numbers up here, the one who made the map. There's the one up here. They come from the north. They move their way, they move way down here. And there's, where's number two? Where'd it go? Okay, this arrow here. They come down here and they attack even south of Edom, the text says. And so they raid into the mountains of Edom. And then numbers three and four. Tell us that the four kings defeat the five smaller vassal kingdoms, including Chedorlaomer, and they attack there in the valley of Siddim, and they take Lot, Abram's nephew. But the story continues. And so we see on this map here that Abram pursues them and he will defeat them. Which means if Abram's going against four powerful armies, Abram must have 10 powerful armies with him. He must have hundreds of thousands of people on his side. What? I'm sorry, what? Okay, he has God on his side, but he must have hundreds of thousands of soldiers too. Maybe a bazooka, tank. What does Abram have with him? 318 soldiers. These are herdsmen. They were trained, though. They were trained. 318 against four powerful armies? It's going to be a slaughter. Well, you know what happens. Let's read it. Verse 13. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew. That's the first time the word Hebrew is used in the Bible. Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were allies of Abram. And we'll see these fellows again at the end, in verse 24. Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre. So tuck that away. So these people tell Abram about what happened. When Abram heard, verse 14, when Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he said, I got to do something about this. He led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, you were right, and went in pursuit as far as Dan, which is the very most northern point of Canaan, the land that Abram and his descendants will have. Verse 15, he divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them, and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. They go way north. So you see, there's Dan, and just a little bit to the north, northeast of that is Damascus. And we'll finish out this little trail here. So Abram takes his 318, they have a battle at Dan, and he continues to pursue them. We're not told a lot of details. We're not told a lot about Abram's strategy or how only 318 soldiers, trained men, defeated these four armies. But you were right when you said the first time, God was on Abram's side. Here is a man who was told to leave Ur of the Chaldeans, travel 1,500 miles to Canaan. He's initially not told where he's going to go. Abram has been told, you will be the father of a great nation. He's 75. His wife is 65. He still has no children. And he's building altars and calling on the name of the Lord. And this is really, I guess, the first time when we see him take action with confidence in the name of the Lord, fighting against these armies. So that's amazing what Abram has done. And he did it with the help of God. Verse 15 says he divided his forces. Verse 16, after they win, they brought back all the possessions and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions and the women and the people. So we have just gone through verses 1 through 16 of Genesis 14 and seen this tremendous battle. Isn't that something? What are your thoughts about Abram and this war that he wages?
Well, knowing the king that he's fighting up against and still put a force together and a smart move, I consider it a picture maneuver.
Okay. Successful and, he had the element of surprise, it seems. Okay, he had confidence in God. Is this stuff made up? I got a quote here. We'll read it together in just a moment. Did you have a comment?
Okay. Yeah, so I think about this story in context with the parable of the lost sheep. You know, the shepherd has 99.
Okay.
Loses one. You know, Abraham doesn't really seem to have a lot invested in Lot. You know, they've kind of parted ways. but he still thinks of him as part of the clan.
That's right.
And far from just like leaving the rest of the sheep behind to wander off and find one, Abraham's prepared to plunge the entire region into warfare to get the one back. At the expense of how many, no one knows. Presumably more than the one he's getting.
Absolutely. So Abram does go save lots of folks, not just Lot.
Yeah, but I mean, there's... It says something about kinship ties, the importance of family, but also if this is what Abraham would do for his relations, how much more will God do to preserve his?
All right. Okay. So you see God very much behind this, protecting Lot. What did God say in the Abrahamic promise? Whoever blesses you, I will bless. Whoever curses you, I will curse. This is part of that protection, that promise that God has made to him. All right, on the screen, I've got a quote by a very conservative scholar I respect a lot, Dr. Ross. And he says, we can't exactly pinpoint where all of these are, but it's certainly fitting. What we have described to us is typical. I guess I should just read it instead of paraphrasing it. The names of the foreign kings in Genesis 14, the nature of city-states banding together in coalitions, the subjugation and rebellion of vassal states, that's the five kings, the vassal states, and the line of march of the invaders, taking that king's highway, all fit the world of the patriarchs, this time of Abraham. So far, however, it has not been possible to identify any of the individual kings mentioned in the lists. It's presented to us as factual historical events, and it's very plausible. It's very reasonable. I'll remind you that archaeologists, they have discovered a lot, but they haven't found everything that's mentioned in the Bible. There was a time when people would read the Bible about Hittites, and they would laugh and ridicule those who believe the Bible that talks about Hittites. And then what did they discover in the early 20th century? They found the Hittites, a complete civilization. Is Keter Lammer's remains out there somewhere? Are his remains out there? His name? You're talking about events that occurred 38, almost 4,000 years ago. We don't know specifically where any record of these folks is, but it's very reasonable to see this is a historical event that took place. It's described to us. What is most unbelievable to me is that Abram defeated all these kings with only 318 trained soldiers. That should jump out at us and make us realize God is keeping his promise. He is going to bless Abram, and those who curse him, he will curse. Any other comments you'd like to make on verses 1 through 16?
Just one comment, and that is the fact that he had 318 trained men.
Okay.
He had his own army. Of course, I'm sure in that area, they travel back and forth with the herds, and they need protection. So I'm sure
all right.
He accommodated them with some training and travel.
All right. Abram's growing in his wealth. Not just silver and gold, but also especially livestock. And he's got lots and lots of servants in his home. I want to get to Melchizedek, so we will continue. As we move on to verse 17, we see in the closing verses of Genesis 14 that God sends, well, what it says is Melchizedek came to him. Verse 17, after his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer, and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shaveh, that is the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. So we've got two kings. One was defeated, the other one was not. The king of Salem was not mentioned prior to this. You got the king of Sodom. So it makes it a little confusing because they both start with S and just have five letters. Sodom and Salem, they are not the same place. They are not the same kingdom at all. What does this mean that Melchizedek, king of Salem, was priest of God Most High? What does that mean?
He's
All right, he served God, the one true God? Is that what this verse is implying? Yes. Just because he's not of the family of Abram doesn't mean that God doesn't have other people who are serving him. Abraham is even called a prophet when he has to pray for Pharaoh back in Genesis 12. Abram is a prophet. What was the difference between a prophet and a priest? You'll hear me talk about this a lot because it's very, very important. A prophet, I'm very simplistic here, but a prophet proclaims the words of God to people. He's basically a preacher. And he represents God to the people. The priest does the opposite. He represents the people to God. So here is a priest of the Most High God who is representing God. God Most High. Let's see what happens. Let's see what transpires here. So we're going to talk about the king of Salem in verses 17 through 20. And then we will talk about the king of Sodom beginning of verse 21. Keep that distinction very clearly here. So Abram returns. Melchizedek, king of Salem, verse 18, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him. Who's doing the blessing here? Melchizedek is the one who's doing the blessing. So let's take a look at that. He blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. And blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And then we are told that Abram gave him a tenth of everything. What did Abram bring back with him from the battle in Dan and Damascus? All the booty, all the spoils of war. He's got all these. And he gives a tenth to Melchizedek. Melchizedek, priest of God Most High. We don't talk about him a lot, do we? He does occur one other time in the Old Testament. Not here in Genesis. This is the only time we see him in Genesis. He is mentioned in one other book in the Old Testament. What book is that? Psalms. What book? The book of Psalms. Psalm 110, verse 4. I heard 104. Well, we'll combine that. 110, verse 4. And it talks about Jesus, or the Messiah, being a priest, but not after the priesthood of Aaron, but a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Does Melchizedek seem to be, based on what we're reading here in Genesis 14, he blesses Abram, and then being mentioned again in the Davidic Psalm 110, do you think he's an important figure? But we know so little about him. So let's make sure we understand what's going on here. Yes? Okay. That's right. Can you hear Jerusalem? Jerusalem and Salem. Are you familiar with the term shalom? So you got S, you got that sh sound, L and M. You've got those same consonants in Salem and shalom. And so when you say that Melchizedek is king of Salem, what you're also saying is he's king of peace. So the country he is king of is the kingdom of peace. We'll get to the Jesus. I mean, you know where we're going with this. We're going to end our class this morning by talking about Jesus and how Melchizedek anticipates him. But for now, let's think about what's going on here. Abram is blessed by Melchizedek. To be blessed by someone, the Hebrew writer is going to make this argument. Does the greater bless the lesser, or does the lesser bless the greater? So Melchizedek's blessing Abram, he is greater than Abraham. He's greater than Abraham. When the Hebrew writer is talking about this, he is talking to his fellow countrymen, the Judeans, talking about the austere, greatly revered Abraham, and he says Melchizedek is greater than him because Melchizedek blessed Abram. And what does he say? He blesses Abram, and blessed be God who has delivered your enemies into your hand. Very clearly, it is indicated that God is the one who helped Abram. I mentioned this at the beginning of our next lesson, which is out in the foyer. We'll be looking at Genesis 15 through 17. But look at this word delivered, this verb, delivered. And then look at verse 1 of Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great. The verb delivered that we're reading here in verse 20 has the same root as the word shield in Genesis 15, verse 1. You have a lot of these links between sections, and that is a link, but it's also significant, where priest of God Most High has just told Abram, the one who delivered everything into your hand, in case you didn't know, Abram, is your deliverer. God Most High delivered you. And then God very plainly says, I am your deliverer. I am your shield. I'm the one who's protecting you and taking care of you. Your reward shall be very great. Your reward. Let's talk about this reward idea. Beginning of verse 21, you have a very ugly, unflattering person. He is the king of Sodom. The king of Sodom is rather insulting, it seems to me. He comes to Abram and he says, Abram, thank you for saving me. Thank you for saving all the citizens of my kingdom and my stuff. Thank you. I'm greatly indebted to God Most High for what you've done. Is that what the king of Sodom says? The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself. It's a little demanding. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have lifted my hand to the Lord, God Most High. That's now the third time we've read that. Possessor of heaven and earth, same exact language from verse 19, that I would not take, I have sworn to the God Most High that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, king of Sodom, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. And then he says, I take nothing but what the young men have eaten, his soldiers, and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share, Abram's allies. Abram takes nothing. Now, he's given a tenth to Melchizedek, but he takes nothing for himself. Why not? All right, so it doesn't come back on him. So that no one says, ah, the king of Sodom really helped you out. What's the big deal? Why is that such a problem? I'll remind you of what Genesis 13, verse 13 says. The men of Sodom were wicked exceedingly and sinners. Do you think that has something to do with Abram wanting to keep the king of Sodom at arm's length? In Genesis 12, as Gus already indicated to us, Genesis 12, when Pharaoh was trying to appease his future brother-in-law, who happened to be married to Sarai, not just simply his sister, when Abram was offered all those animals, oxen and cattle and sheep, by Pharaoh, did Abram say then, oh no, I can't take these. I can't take these. Sir? He took it. He accepted it. But now we see a change. What's going on?
The association.
All right. He wants to keep the king of Sodom away. Absolutely. I think that's also what we're seeing here. He is becoming more and more dependent, trusting God. Does God take care of Abram? Does he bless him materially? You bet. He's going to bless Isaac. He's going to bless Jacob. God told him that he would. At first, it seems Abram took matters into his own hands. Yes, sir.
Well, he tells us why he's doing this when he says, lest people say
okay.
That Solomon has done this.
Right.
And he has already proclaimed that the Lord God has blessed him and given him the same.
Absolutely. So when we look at chapters 13 and 14 together, we do see Abram not wanting to associate with the king of Sodom and his evil. But also he's just saying, look, I don't want anyone to say I got rich because of king of Sodom or anyone else for that matter. He's serving the Lord. The Lord is going to take care of him. Is that a fair representation of what you're saying? I hope so. So this is very important to Abram. He says, sure, my allies, they can take what they want, and that's where the narrative ends. But Abram says, I have sworn to the Lord, God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, I will not take anything from you at all. Abram starting to assert himself. Now, what this means is, from here on out, the narrative of Abraham will come to an end in Genesis 24. We are never going to see Abram have a lapse of faith. He's always going to have his confidence in God. What? Nope. But he is growing. Wouldn't you say? He's getting better. He's getting better. What we're going to see is Abram not trust God that he will provide him a son. Can you blame Abram? He's 75 years old. His wife is 10 years his senior, so she's 65. And God says, I'm going to give you a son. It's going to be your son, Abram. And what we're going to see next week in Genesis 15 is Abram just can't believe it. And he and his wife decide we're going to help God out. And through the Levirate law, we sometimes call it, Abram fathers a child through another woman. And that child is born. And God is going to tell Abram what? Great! Thanks for helping me out. That's wonderful. Oh, he's going to say, no. I'll take care of Ishmael. But that's not the son of promise. All right, I'm getting a little ahead of myself. And we do now need to talk about Melchizedek. I do want to stray over to Hebrews. Let's take a look at Hebrews 5 first. Again, Melchizedek's only mentioned here in Genesis 14. In Psalm 110, verse 4. You are priest forever after the order of Melchizedek, and no great elaboration is made. I'm looking at Hebrews 5, and you have Melchizedek mentioned for the first time in the New Testament in Hebrews 5, verse 10. The Hebrew writer is talking about Jesus and how he is he was made perfect, became the source of eternal salvation to all obey him, being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. About this, we have much to say, and it is hard to explain, since you have become dull of hearing. And then the Hebrew writer for the next chapter chides them for their lack of Bible knowledge. And then he resumes in chapter 7, verse 1. Let me now talk to you about Melchizedek. And he lists 10 characteristics of Melchizedek. So let's go through this. Hebrews 7, 1 through 3. And now what we're doing is comparing Melchizedek to Jesus. First he says, for this Melchizedek, king of Salem. So we've got his name, and we're told that he is king of Salem. He is priest of the Most High God. He's not some slouch. He met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him. So the greater blessed the lesser. Melchizedek blessed Abraham. To him, Abraham apportioned a tenth of everything. And then we are told he is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness. Now, he's also the king of peace, because he's the king of Salem. And then he is also king of Salem, that is, the king of peace. And then he says he is without father or mother. He is without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. But like the Son of God, or resembling the Son of God, He continues a priest forever. See how great this man was to whom Abraham the patriarch gave a tenth of the spoils. This man is greater than Abraham. And so he is also described as a priest forever. What is the Hebrew writer doing here? What this makes Melchizedek sound like is some really mysterious person. When I read this, what I'm wondering is if he is taking what little information we have and he's applying it to Jesus. Did Melchizedek have parents? Did the man Melchizedek have parents? Okay, you say yes. Some people say, well, no, he just came out of nowhere. Some people even say, maybe this is even Jesus himself. Okay, help me out.
In the context of first century Judaism, lots of the Old Testament apocryphal books are actually just like prequels and sequels of characters that are talked about in the Old Testament.
All right.
But like the Jewish readers wanted them to be better established. So like, oh, but who's that person actually related to? And what did they do after that? And like a lot of the apocryphal works of the Old Testament are kind of speculative and creative writing efforts. And I think in essence he's kind of like pointing out that like no one went back and did that for Melchizedek.
Okay.
It's like we don't know who his parents are because it's not recorded in God's word.
All right, it's effectively like not having family. What I thought you were going to say is talk about the Midrashic interpretation of the Old Testament. So he's plucking this incident in Genesis 14, and he's saying, we don't know much about Melchizedek. Let me tell you, that relates very well to Jesus. Because does Jesus have a mother? Well, yeah, he was born of a virgin, but did she create him? No. He's always been. He's always existed. Melchizedek, we're not told about his birth. We're not told about his death. So it's as if there was no beginning for Melchizedek and there's no end for him. This is from the Hebrew writer. Divine commentary on Melchizedek. He resembles the Son of God. How does Melchizedek resemble the Son of God? He's very close to God. He is a priest of the Most High God. And he's a priest forever because we're never told about him dying. It's as if he lives forever. The name, Melchizedek, that literally means King of Righteousness. Is that a good title for Jesus the Messiah as well? He's the King of Righteousness. He's also the King of Peace. He is the King of Salem. And as Julie has already pointed out, Jerusalem is very significant in the history of God's covenant people. So he is a priest of the Most High God. He blessed Abraham. So he is greater than Abraham. Is Jesus greater than Abraham? Yes. Well, wait a minute. I thought the Father was supposed to be greater than the Son. But in the case of Jesus, that's reversed. All right, before Abraham was, I am. Okay, so here in our study of Genesis, we see Jesus yet again. Jesus is a priest, not after the order of Melchizedek. And if we were to continue reading in Genesis 7, and I do have some notes on this, we are told that there's verse 17, quoting Psalm 110, verse 4, "For it is witnessed of him, you are a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek." Under the Old Covenant, and we're almost out of time here, we've got about another minute. Under the Old Covenant, could Jesus have been a priest? Why not? He was not a Levite. And so as a result, there had to be a change of priesthood. And I want to close with these verses here at the end of at the end of Hebrews 7. "For it is indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest," talking about Jesus, "holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those priests, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins, and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. The law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son to whom who has been made perfect forever. As great and magnificent as Abraham was, Melchizedek was greater than him. As great and wonderful as a priest of God Most High Melchizedek was, who is even greater than him? Jesus, our true high priest. Does Jesus represent us to God? He is our high priest. Jesus is also representing God to us. That makes him God's prophet. So Jesus is prophet, and he is priest. And just like Melchizedek was king, what is Jesus? He is king. He is King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Jesus is our prophet, our priest, and our king. All nestled in Genesis 14. All right, we're going to cover three chapters next week, Genesis 15 through 17. Thank you for your participation this morning.